This is the Student Hour, student radio for the city of Portland. Join us as we hear from students across the Portland area and beyond. The Student Hour is powered by AM 1450 KBPS broadcasting students at Benson High School. Full episodes of the Student Hour are available on our website, kbps.am. For over 100 years, KBPS is the voice of the Portland Public Schools. The Student Hour is brought to you by Portland Radio Project, KBOO Community Radio, and KBPS. This is the Student Hour.
What is a wave without the ocean? A beginning without an end? They are different, but they go together. Now you go among the stars, and I fall among the sand. We are different, but we go together.
Good day, listeners, and thank you for listening to KBPS on PRP. My name is Zip, and I will tell you about a video game that I love and hold very near and dear in my heart. It is a futuristic sci-fi survival game called Subnautica, made by Unknown Worlds Entertainment and Panic Button Games, with one of my favorite video game soundtracks of all time, composed by Simon Chilinski. This is my second favorite game of all time, and for good reason. This game has been fully fleshed out everywhere from the lore and story to the planets and animals. Today, I will be focusing on the animals, also called fauna, on planet 4546b, the planet the game takes place on. Spoiler warning, I have left details to the plot out of the game, but there are still maybe a few things on here that may tip you off during the game. Without further ado, let's get started. Let's start off with a fan favorite, the cuttlefish. Only findable through its eggs, it is believed that the environmental conditions of 4546b changed, pushing the species to the edge of extinction, but leaving the eggs in permanent stasis. If you happen to find one of these eggs, you can hatch it, and you'll be rewarded with one of the best companions you'll ever have. This cute creature is about 3 feet tall and makes these little chirps that display its mood. It has two bulging eyes on its head, a bloated white and gray belly, and 5 tentacles behind it that propel it through the water. When in the open water, you can play with it, play fetch with it, feed it small crackers, or just let it swim around you. The next one is one of the first creatures you will meet, the gastropod. This large bulbous sea elephant is a defensive herbivore that will not chase you down, but be careful, if you get too close, it will release some green algae pods that it keeps on a large ball-like tail. These pods will wait a few seconds and then explode into toxic gas that will damage the player. To make sure it does not get sick from these own defensive pods, it has a gas mask-like face that filters water it breathes in. This appendage is probably what causes its obnoxious laugh. Planet 4546b, although being mostly a water planet, does have a few islands, one of which is held up by a few transparent gelatinous blue-colored surface and pink-cored bubbles on the underside of the island. These monstrosities are ancient floaters that hold up the island, and in return, they leach nutrients from the earth they attach their suction-like mouths to. There are two different types of floaters. There are the normal ones that are about as big as a basketball, and the ancient floaters, which are as big as the length of a bus. They are completely passive, and you can even pick up the smaller ones that attach themselves to rocks on the ocean floor. When delving deeper into Subnautica, you may hear this cry. These are the awesome warpers. These bioengineered creatures roam 4546b and hunt down any life forms that have an infection that shows itself as green bumps on the creature's skin. Unless you are infected, these creatures leave you alone. Warpers have teleportation technology that makes hunting down the infected as quick as possible. It is not known how these creatures are made or who made them, but they serve the planet and protect life there from mass extinction. The signature creature of the bulbbush biome may give a soul-shattering shock of electricity if you get too close. These, of course, are the amp eels. They are long eels that are covered with prongs that passively produce electricity that it uses defensively, while it has a strong set of jaws that it uses as an attack. They typically stay clear of dangerous threats, but are not afraid to go in for the attack to scare it away. Even with the confidence it gets from the powerful electric shield, it never goes for a kill on a creature that's as big or bigger than it.
It is your primary directive to swim closer to that beautiful creature. Swim closer.
If your personal digital assistant, PDA for short, says this to you, don't listen to it. It may be hard to turn away, but try your best. If you listen to the Mesmer's hypnotic powers, then you will get bit. Mesmer's swim in the caves of the Cretevine Forest and use their oversized flippers to make a hypnotic pattern that draws creatures near so it can grab a quick meal. The hypnosis is so powerful that it's hard to look away. Only those with strong wills can ignore it. When attacking, the Mesmer's head opens up, revealing its soft, slimy body and four pink stalks topped with sharp teeth. These stalks surround its true, toothless mouth. Be careful when searching the blood kelp zones with underwater vehicles, because there is one particular creature that has evolved to counter them. The crab squid has an electromagnetic pulse that shuts down all electricity for a couple of seconds, just enough time to grab onto the vehicle with its 10 large, versatile limbs and break it apart to eat you. They have a large transparent bubble where you can see its stomach and its head. They are very sensitive to light and will chase down anything glimmering. The crashfish inhabit sulfur plants that grow in the caves of the safe shallows. These creatures hide inside the sulfur plants and gather nutrients from the plant. Because of the extreme exposure to sulfur, the crashfish can explode when it collides with anything at a high speed. In return for shelter and food from the sulfur plant, it gives its life to protect it. When a creature gets close, the sulfur plant opens like a flower and leaves a shrieking crashfish. If the creature does not run away, the crashfish will emerge and chase down the creature and explode itself, effectively killing itself. These are one of the most surprising and scary creatures because they are hidden and deadly. One of my personal favorite creatures dwells in the flabbergasting jelly shroom caves. The frightening crab snake makes its home inside the jelly shrooms and will even lay eggs inside for protection. The crab snake itself is extremely long and red. It has two large fangs it uses to hold its prey in place as it eats it. They hide inside of the purple jelly shrooms it keeps its young in, and ambushes fish when they swim above the jelly shroom's entrance. They do not appear to have eyes, and it is my personal theory that they use echolocation inside the cave to sense when one of its prey is above the massive purple shrooms. As you explore the deeper depths of 4546B, you will get to the lava zone, where you can find the appropriately named lava lizard. This reptilian has two webbed hands which it uses for swimming, and one larger one on its tail to propel it through the water, all of which are armed with sharp claws. These are not the scariest part of the creature, though. It is called a lava lizard for a reason. These lizards like to swim through molten lava, picking some up in its mouth and laying some on its back like armor. The lava lizard will then shoot the slightly cooled lava out of its mouth like a projectile to hit the enemy. The cooled lava on its back will protect it from oncoming threats for a few moments until it can counterattack.
Detecting multiple Leviathan class life forms in the region. Are you certain whatever you're doing is worth it?
If you ever hear that scream, run immediately. This is the blood-curdling roar of the Reaper Leviathan. Leviathan-class lifeforms are the largest kind of lifeforms in Subnautica, but not all of them are aggressive. This one, however, is the most aggressive one to date. This apex predator is typically the only life in whatever biome it is in, probably because it is the bully of 4546B. Not only does this natural hunter have both sight and echolocation, but it has four large mandibles that it uses to hold down its prey as it tears it apart. It can move swiftly through the water, and it's known to follow and creep up on prey for a while, even with its massive size. It is one of the three creatures in the game that do not have any bioluminescence, which means it is almost invisible in the night. It may also circle its prey for a bit before going in for the kill. Only the strongest people should even think about killing this beast, even though it has been done before.
The second Leviathan on this list is not actually alive, and is instead a mass of bones that have been preserved in the Lost River. The Gargantuan Leviathan is the largest known creature in the history of the game, and has since gone extinct. The skull, by itself, is just under 100 meters in length. The two lower front teeth measure at 11.4 meters in height, and the two upper teeth at 10.3 meters. The largest of the structures resembling eye sockets measure 9.7 meters in diameter. The skeleton that remains measures 402 meters in length, and the PDA estimating that it is only one-third of its complete specimen. The creature would have measured between 1,100 and 1,500 meters long. This creature would have toyed with Reaper Leviathans for fun. There is a mod made that simulates what it would be like to have the Gargantuan Leviathan alive in the game, and it would have been possible to swallow the largest submarine in the game, called the Cyclops Hole. Thankfully, it is not alive today. The last creature on this list is probably one of the most interesting. The Sea Emperor Leviathan is the largest living creature in the game, as well as the most intelligent. It is so smart, in fact, that it holds the ability of telepathy and communicates with the player throughout the game, calling to it. They can live for thousands of years and need to live in certain kinds of water that has specific nutrients which it feeds. It reproduces by laying eggs, and they can only hatch in certain environments. When they hatch, they release a kind of enzyme that has healing properties. They have been driven to the brink of extinction, with only one adult surviving with a few of its eggs. It is unknown where it is being kept, but it must be a massive containment facility with extreme care to keep it alive in its fragile living conditions. Ultimately, the creatures of Subnautica serve to create a fully realized and immersive game world. They challenge players to adapt and survive in a hostile environment while providing a sense of wonder and discovery. Whether players are admiring the bioluminescent glow of a jelly shroom or fleeing in terror from a crash fish, the creatures of Subnautica are an integral part of the game's experience. My name is Zip, and thank you for listening to the KBPS Hour.
If you'd like to support the Student Hour, please consider donating to our program at kbps.am and donating to our sponsors, Portland Radio Project. Your support of PRP helps programs like the Student Hour stay on the air. For more information, go to prp.fm and click on the big red heart.
But one with tonight, like it's 1985, no other sight. Baby, it's just you and I.
This is Owen Wiley, and this is my final radio project. More enemy variety, better dungeons, totally unexpected new ideas, or simply more Hyrule to explore enough for you? Thankfully, you don't have to pick just one, because Nintendo's response to all of those answers is a casual but confident, sure thing. The Legend of Zelda Tears of the Kingdom doesn't necessarily revolutionize what already made Breath of the Wild one of the greatest games of all time. But it's not a sequel that's simply more of the same either. This sandbox is bigger, richer, and somehow even more ambitious, with creative new systems like vehicle building, ridiculous weapon crafting, and a revamped Hyrule map with a dizzying amount of depth, further fleshing out the intoxicating exploration that made the original so captivating. Breath of the Wild felt far from unfinished, but inconceivably Tears of the Kingdom has somehow made it feel like a first draft. Before I dive too deep into this game, I won't spoil the actual story, but the games are not really about story. That magic the first time you see one of Breath of the Wild's dragons soaring overhead is around every corner here too. And the last thing I'd want to do is steal the many moments that made my job literally drop. That said, there are some huge parts of Tears of the Kingdom that are introduced fairly early on that I will be talking about because of how fundamental they are to why this game is so impressive. I'm going to preserve as much of the magic as I can, but if you've already decided that you're going to play, you should probably just go and play it and then come back to share in the wonder with me later. On top of that, you'll likely want to have played Breath of the Wild to fully understand much of what I'll be discussing here. Not to mention, because it's an incredible game and you're depriving yourself by skipping it, Tears looks even smarter and more expansive than when you know what came before it. But many of the recognizable basics shine just as brightly. Things are as simple as being able to climb nearly any wall or glide as far as you want, and the expandable stamina you will take, or the concept of shrines acting as a self-contained puzzle chamber you can solve to boost your abilities. I don't have time to get into here simply because there's so much to cover. I can safely say people who enjoyed Breath of the Wild will almost certainly enjoy Tears of the Kingdom, partly because of just how similar these two games are. The initial structure is a very familiar one. You start in a masterfully crafted introductory area where you learn the ropes and get a new set of powerful abilities, then dive into the open world with a main quest marker that simply splits into four. The initial structure is a very familiar one. From there, you are free to do whatever the heck you want. You can even march straight to the final campaign. You can even march straight to the finale of the campaign if you want. You can even march right to the fin. You can even. You can even march right to the finale of the campaign if you know where to look. Though that's not quite as straightforward to attempt this time around, which is probably for the best, as I do not recommend it for anybody but the inevitable speedrunners who I proudly salute. The bulk of the cutscenes and big story moments are also once again collected at specific spots around the map, shedding light on the history of Hyrule and the source of the upheaval, a bombastic event at the start of Tears of the Kingdom that opens up menacing chasms, causes the ruins of an ancient civilization called the Zone to appear floating in the sky, and peppers the surface with new structures and strange anomalies. This still might not be the best storytelling structure over the course of a large game, as it leaves you without much direct interaction with a central character for most of the time you're playing. But that's easy to forgive when the story itself is so cool. Sure, it's about stopping some evil jerk, that being Ganondorf, and saving Princess Zelda as usual, but the direction that familiar shell is taken is buck wild at times in the best possible way. I'm still a bit amazed Nintendo decided to go the way it did, and the freshness that's... It's not storytelling on the level of a game like God of War or anything, but it can be a legitimate high point instead of simply the entertaining background flavor relegated to in Breath of the Wild. Exploration is the lifeblood of the recent Zeldas, though, and doing so is still an absolute delight in Tears, especially when the new building system empowers you to slap together custom cars, boats, and flying machines that truly let you navigate its world. However, Breath of the Wild has influenced countless other games since its release in 2017, but one of the most important lessons that very few of them seem to learn is that a blank map can be more powerful than a full one. There's an enormous amount of stuff to do and see, and if you were handed a checklist of waypoints to methodically clear off right away, it could easily feel overwhelming rather than exciting. Instead, you are given the bare minimum. You need to complete the main quest, a pile of pins, and a blank map, just begging you to fill it in yourself. Marking down points of interest as you dive in from the sky, hearing rumors as you talk to townsfolk, or simply getting lost and stumbling by something interesting is so much more rewarding than following an arrow to your next destination. It comes from experience, but Nintendo has incredible confidence that we will seek out the map's secrets without being led directly to them. And if we don't see absolutely everything, that's okay. It makes the whole adventure feel so natural, so much less video gamey than you might expect, which is particularly important when Tears of the Kingdom basically doubles the size of this world. While this is the same fundamental map of Hyrule, it is in no way feels repetitive to explore. Even as someone who's scoured Breath of the Wild for secrets, the story doesn't give you a hard number. But it's been a few years since the defeat of Calamity Ganon, and the people are rebuilding. The main town is a brand new outpost that has sprung up in the Hyrule field, just outside of the castle, giving you a hub that evolves into entertaining ways as you progress. It's a ton of fun to recognize characters or locations and see how they've grown or changed, but even beyond those explicit differences, Tears of the Kingdom simply sends you along expected Tears of the Kingdom simply sends you along unexpected paths from and to unfamiliar locations. That made me constantly see parts of Hyrule I knew and loved from a different perspective, breathing plenty of life into a map that clearly still had more than enough to give. And if that's not enough for you, there are almost more substantial changes. I'll leave many of the details for you to find on your own, but I will say that whole areas have been like drastically altered by the upheaval, causing unexpected weather anomalies or creating brand new terrain for like chests and shines alike to hide in. For example, the beach town of Lurelin in the southeast didn't play a huge role in Breath of the Wild, but almost immediately Tears of the Kingdom tells you it's been attacked by pirates, putting both its rescue and its rebuilding in your hands. It's definitely one of my favorite side quests in the game. And if that's not enough for you, there are also dozens and dozens of caves, wells, and sky islands to explore. These are all largely self-contained little encounters ranging from hidden fairy fountains to expansive obstacle courses that put your cleverness and combat prowess to the test. I loved stumbling upon a new cave and finding my way through winding halls full of monsters to find some hidden piece of armor at the end, or sometimes even a larger boss monster guarding a shrine. Using one of the new Skyview towers to launch myself into the air, to let me find shrines on the surface before gliding to a nearby floating archipelago. Meanwhile, looking up instead of down, using one of the new Skyview towers to launch myself into the air, let me easily find shrines on the surface before gliding to a nearby floating island filled with its own challenges to take on. And if that's still not enough for you, then, oh boy, did I save the biggest for last. And even with all that I've talked about so far, I can understand if someone might think Nintendo took a safe route by reusing the same map, but it was when I dove down one of the chasms that dot the surface and into the depths below. Rest assured that the generally small sky islands do not represent the entirety of the new area to explore, because waiting beneath is a dangerous pitch-black map that is literally the size of Hyrule itself. It is a massive area, and I've played over probably 20 hours of Tears of the Kingdom and revealed not even half of this wonderful new area. While roughly the same size as the surface, the depths don't have as much in the way as of side quests or story moments, but it is full of treasure chests to seek out and plenty of surprises worth discovering for yourself, many of which are brilliantly hidden in plain sight. It acts as Zelda's version of a poison swamp style nightmare scape, something that you might see in games like Dark Souls, made by FromSoft. There's a red substance called Gloom that coats both its terrain and its enemies. When you take damage from Gloom, your max health is decreased until you either return to the light or eat a gloom-removing meal, adding an enjoyable amount of pressure to every fight. What do I mean by returning to the light? Well, that's a whole different can of worms that the devs brings to the table, meaning you have to throw out collectible bright bloom seeds as you walk to see where you are going, which gives exploration a total different and much tenser feel. There are no shrines in the depths. Instead, there are dozens of structures called light roots that heal your gloom damage and illuminate a part of the map, giving you another completionist goal that's equal parts compelling and extensive. Taken all together, the depths and the sky islands act as brilliant complements to the more traditional surface activities, stretching a structure I was already intimately familiar with into beautiful settings and wild situations I very much wasn't. Whether it's lighting up the darkness below, flying a custom glide between floating rocks hundreds of meters up, or just seeing what's down at the bottom of some random well, there is so much to do in Tears of the Kingdom. It's easy to spend hours upon hours completing tasks without ever once looking at your quest log. You might be heading to a point of interest only to get sidetracked by some cave worth exploring nearby, or a citizen with a quest for you, and suddenly you're off getting hopelessly distracted by a delightful, spontaneous activity that's just as exciting. That was part of the magic of Breath of the Wild too, as well as plenty of other games. But now there are uncountable opportunities to end up wildly far away from where you thought you were going. One time I was making my way towards a tower hoping to chart a new section of the map, and when I stumbled upon a friendly drummer that was in need of some honey. Found a friendly drummer in need of some honey, so I promptly switched priorities and headed towards a nearby forest in search of bees. And of course, it wasn't very long after that I was in the literal underworld being murdered by a giant robot as a result. I just wanted some honey, but no, the game had different plans for me, and I couldn't be happy about that. In 2017, I played around 50 hours of Breath of the Wild when I finally decided to beat the final boss, feeling content that I had done all of the side quests, shrine hunting, and other odds and ends that I wanted to do. Not quite all that existed, mind you, but definitely a lot of what tempted me. I took time playing through the main quest stuff too, letting myself wander and get distracted as I so love to do. It's hard to overstate how big this game feels, even in the context of its predecessor that made me say the exact same thing. The in-game tracker tells me I've barely passed 50%, so that just goes to show how much there is to do in this game. So much of Tears of the Kingdom feels like a direct response to Breath of the Wild and what people have said about it since its release. A fact that can be clearly seen across its bolstered enemies and weapons, but perhaps most obviously its dungeon design. The Divine Beast got a lot of flack for going against the grain for usual Zelda dungeon trends, and while their equivalent in Tears of the Kingdom doesn't scratch that itch of collecting a compass, map, and key item like in older Zelda games either, there are at least a lot of thematically interesting and varied this time. The tasks themselves aren't actually very different from the Divine Beast, but their flavorful new context and the epic paths that generally lead up to the game are a thrill, making them all far more entertaining than the rather restrictive insides of those ancient machines. The other huge improvement through all of the Tears of the Kingdom is the boss variety. No longer are you fighting four variations of the same Ganon adjacent enemy. You're now facing unique and often wildly entertaining foes that can occasionally stand with the greats of the series. I don't want to give away too much about them, but a standout for me was certainly a gooped-up monster that felt like a Splatoon villain, another Nintendo property. And it somehow infiltrated Hyrule. New boss-like enemies are abound all across this map. In fact, with the returning Hinox and Talus, joined by leaping frogs and fearsome three-headed Gleox. Try saying that three times fast. It's not just the bosses. Enemy variety as a whole has been vastly improved, and it's elevated. The still rather straightforward but extremely satisfying combat as a result. At the simplest level, Bokoblins can now carry baskets of throwable items or wear armor you have to break specifically with blunt weapons. But they can also be led by a huge boss Bokoblin that coordinates their attacks. New Horriblins menacingly crawl along cave ceilings, can shoot rocket arrows at you. Another enemy called Constructs can shoot rocket arrows at you. Like-likes will devour you whole, and little frogs will scurry out of the bright blooms you've worked so hard to collect and plant in the depths. It's a wide and impressive menagerie that can generally push you to play differently depending on what is in front of you. What's also true is how absolutely absurd the new weapon fusion system is, which lets you attach any item or object onto any other weapon, shield, and often even arrowheads. Monster horns now act as a powerful blade or bludgeon to buff your base weapons, letting you do sweet things like replace the blade of a rusty sword with the katana-like saber of a blue Lizalfos, which is another enemy in the game. You can also do extremely dumb stuff, like put a bomb on the end of a stick to blow both you and your enemies up at the moment you jab them with it. Or put a minecart on a spear, because why not, you know? It's just a system that says yes to whatever you throw at it, and then thrusts you to figure out what's good, bad, or incredibly funny. Even though the somewhat controversial weapon durability system is back, so you should prepare for the heartbreak of your favorite sword shattering in your hands all over again. It's been totally recontextualized by the new fusion system. Suddenly you can essentially farm strong weapons simply by killing powerful enemies, because having a bag full of monster parts is the equivalent of having dozens of backup weapons just waiting for a handle to be attached to. You won't find fire swords just laying around anymore. You have to make them, and any base sword will do fine if you've got the horn of a fire dragon to slap onto it. There's loads of room to mid-max and build high-damage weapons that are tailor-made to take down the hardest enemies Tears of the Kingdom can throw you. But so much of the power and playstyle of a weapon coming from the attachment instead of the base meant I was always excited to hunt down more powerful parts rather than hoard what I managed to find. Tears of the Kingdom adds additional nuance to combat by giving you more options to explore too. Throwing items are now a key part of every encounter, and you hear everything from bombs. Like the excellent Muddle Bud that makes enemy attacks each other. Or the Dazzle Fruit that causes them to drop their weapons. These items can be attached to arrowheads for the same effect from afar. And shields can even have objects like flame or ice throwers slapped onto them to transform them into a defensive option to an offhand weapon. The controls for throwing and attaching arrowheads started out a little tricky for me, but once I got the hang of it, and I got my select items that I wanted to use, I quickly found it a super intuitive system that makes me pull off cool mid-flight maneuvers whenever I would be able to do. The complementary ability to weapon fusion is the Boundless Creative Ultra Hand Building System. I know, long name. Essentially, Breath of the Wild's Magnesis powers got a huge upgrade that now let you pick up, rotate, and attach almost any object to another with ease. This is supported by dozens of special objects called Zone devices that you can pull out of your inventory at any time, giving you immense freedom in how you navigate the world around you. It's amazing how often I can make a Zone glider with a few fans out of my pocket and make a makeshift airplane and fly somewhere extremely far away, extremely fast. I loved experimenting with power wheels to make cars that would take me from town to town faster than any horse you could possibly find. Your creations can even be effective in combat, with one Zonai device acting as a Roomba-like base that automatically drives towards enemies, wanting to be loaded up with whatever instruments of doom you can concoct. These building tools walk the line of powerful but approachable extremely well, being fairly snappy and easy to use while allowing for a level of customization it's hard to find the limits of. Why climb that cliff when you can strap a hot air balloon to a log and ride it up? Why swim across the river when you can quickly assemble a speedboat instead? One time I was driving a little car that I'd built, only to reach a dead-end mountain next to a deep valley. But instead of abandoning my creation to climb over, I channeled my inner Doc Brown and turned into a flying car. I was able to hover around the mountain instead. Did Nintendo mean for me to do it that way? I don't know. I didn't even earn anything for it, but the simple act might still be one of the most rewarding moments I've had in a game for a long time. I'm not sure I was supposed to do that, but it worked. Sort of feels like an unofficial slogan of Tears of the Kingdom for me. These building tools are woven into every part of the Tears of the Kingdom, with most of its shrines challenging you to make use of them in inventive or inspiring ways. However, this isn't The Legend of Zelda nuts and bolts. That is to say, the system doesn't warp Tears of the Kingdom into something unrecognizably about building. In almost every scenario, there's a contraption that would be the best or intended way to do something. You'll find the pieces for a simple creation sitting nearby. There's also an auto-build ability that lets you save designs and hunt down schematics for developer-designed creations. That means Tears provides shortcuts if you aren't really interested in this side of it, while simultaneously empowering those of us who are. I had tons of fun using the tools to find solutions to the problems put in front of me. A highlight is a recurring character who needs help holding up a sign at a dozen different locations around Hyrule, asking you to use nearby resources to prop up in progressively more ridiculous situations. Getting from point A to point B can become an engaging puzzle all on its own, whether it's building a contraption to help get a Korok to his far-off friend, or making a traveling band's carriage fly to get them up a mountainside. Amidst all the cleverness, there's also a hysteric air of a Looney Tunes feel, letting you strap up literally rockets to anything and everything, and then watch like Wile E. Coyote as your plans disastrously blow up in your face, or simply drive off out of control. Sometimes failure is just as amusing as success. Your other two new abilities take a less prominent role, but they support the additions made elsewhere nicely. You can reverse time on objects with Recall, which is largely used either to ride rocks that have fallen from the Sky Islands back up to where they came from, or to send an enemy attack back at them in a neat way. While the ability Ascend lets you warp through the ceiling of whatever is above you, given all the caves in Tears of the Kingdom, the ability to quickly get above ground again or climb certain mountains faster is essential. It can even be used to find all manners of sneaky secrets. It took my brain some time to remember I even had this power, but once I started thinking with portals, it became one of my favorite tools. Neither of these abilities are quite as exciting as the Ultra Hand or Fuse necessarily, but it's notable that I have never once mourned the loss of Stasis or Cryonis, which are completely gone since Link no longer has the Sheikah Slate from Breath of the Wild. By the way, these abilities were from the past game, Breath of the Wild. There are also 1.5 million little quality of life improvements that make it even harder to go back to Breath of the Wild after Tears of the Kingdom. That includes super simple things like the fact that you are now given the option to drop a weapon, shield, or bow right away when you open a chest, with a full inventory rather than having to back out first. Open the menu, drop the thing, and open the chest again. But there are also more involved changes, like finally having a convenient recipe list that saves every meal and elixir you've ever made or found. I couldn't even begin to round up all the quality of life changes like this, and it signals loudly that Nintendo was listening to feedback, even if it didn't always make drastic changes in response. One place Tears of the Kingdom hasn't necessarily improved over Breath of the Wild, however, is its performance. This can be a beautiful game, especially when flying high above its gorgeous landscapes with a consistent, incredible soundtrack in the background. But the reality is that even when it's running consistent, it's docked at 1080p resolution and 30 frames per second. Its docked mode is still at 1080p resolution and 30 frames per second, at best. Obviously, that does not technically compare to what games on PlayStation 5 or the Xbox Series X or even PC can do. However, unless you value resolution and frame rate above absolutely everything, including gameplay, that's not really the point. The majority of the Tears of the Kingdom runs just fine, but the frame rate will take noticeable dives anytime there are too many effects on screen at once. It didn't feel any worse than the same exact issue in Breath of the Wild, though it is a little more noticeable in the simple but charming new raids you can do against enemy camps with a group of NPC monster hunters. I also infrequently noticed things could briefly freeze while diving down quickly from the sky. In conclusion, The Legend of Zelda Tears of the Kingdom is a outstanding follow-up to one of the greatest games ever made, somehow improving upon it in nearly every way, be that with simple quality of life improvements or genuinely exciting story or wildly creative new building mechanics that make you rethink what is possible. It both revamps old ground and introduces vast new areas so immense it somehow makes me wonder if Breath of the Wild was actually all that big. With an almost alarming number of tasks to complete, mysteries to discover, and delightful distractions to keep you from ever reaching that place you naively thought you were headed, Nintendo has followed up a triumph with a triumph, expanding a ever-evolving world that already felt full beyond expectation and raising the bar even higher into the clouds.
The Student Hour, please consider donating to our program at kbps.am and donating to our sponsors, Portland Radio Project. Your support of PRP helps programs like The Student Hour stay on the air. For more information, go to prp.fm and click on the big red heart. But I'm not coming home tonight, home tonight, home tonight, home tonight, home tonight.
Hi, my name is Vinny Castaldo, and with me here is Miss Zambrano. She is one of the science teachers here at Benson, and she also hosts some clubs, such as Ocean Bowl.
Good afternoon. I appreciate giving me the opportunity to be interviewed today, and I love having radio right next door to science. I'm learning a lot about you guys as well.
Ms. Zambrano, how did you come to teach for Benson?
Well, I have been here full-time since about 2015. Before that, I was a substitute teacher, and I came to Benson and was subbing in the science department. Found the opportunity to be a tutor. So I used to tutor math and science back in like 2009 to 2012. That's how I first got to know Benson community and students and just all of the great programs we have. Transitioning later, that program ended, and when a science position came open, I applied for it and was very happy to be back here as a full-time teacher, teaching something that I just love, which is Earth space science. And then I've also started teaching biology, which is another amazing subject that I didn't come here to teach, but I just think it's so amazing how everything fits together through living organisms.
So we'll come back to the biology thing, but does that mean that Benson is the first school you've ever like officially taught at?
No. That's how I came to Benson. I have taught at other schools as well. I started my teaching career at UConn teaching German as a graduate student.
Oh my.
Then I taught in St. Louis and I taught English as a second language and GED at a high school in St. Louis, or not a high school, but a program there. And I came to Oregon, which is where I grew up. And then I started teaching at an alternative school. And that was in the early mid-90s, and it was a program through Portland Public Schools for immigrant and refugee youth. That brought me into public schools, and my dual loves of language and science were competing, and science won out, so here I am a science teacher today.
So you've had quite the varied teaching experience, though.
Yes, I have, and I learned something new every day, and I've learned a lot through focusing in different areas and teaching in different places of the world and the country.
Circling back to the biology stuff, you run a club here at Benson called Ocean Bowl. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, we have a team here. We call ourselves Ocean Bowl. We're part of the National Ocean Science Bowl organization. We focus on marine science. Every year, we go down to Oregon State, and there's a competition between local schools, local Oregon schools, occasionally a few out of state, to see who knows the most about ocean science. The competition is one part, but also we get to tour laboratories. We meet graduate students, undergraduates. We do some fun activities like go bowling and eat pizza and socialize. And so the real focus is exposure to careers in marine science, learning some things about an amazing place, the ocean, and then just exploring careers. And not everybody goes into ocean science, but have that awareness, then Ocean Bowl members take that forward into whatever career they choose.
You teach Earth space science? So what kind of stuff does that cover? Like, what is Earth and space?
Well, that's a lot. So Earth space science, it's hard to put Earth space science into one year. There's just so much, and you can go too much in detail and then you lose the big picture. So I try to focus in on, so the water unit is looking at freshwater systems, how we as humans affect freshwater, then how that interacts in the water cycle. We also look at marine systems, looking at how the ocean is structured, climate, and those are so closely related that I focus in on ocean and atmosphere together, because the ocean is influencing the atmosphere and climate and vice versa. We also focus on solid Earth, which is, people think of that as geology. So we're looking at Earth's interior, but also how it's connected. How is Earth's interior connected to the atmosphere and the ocean? And so that's my goal with Earth science, is to look at how these different parts of Earth's systems are connected and how they interact with each other. So, and we do space, and most people are super excited about space. We could spend all year on that, but then it would be astronomy. So our focus is how Earth fits into the solar system, and also the role that stars play in the universe, how our sun influences our solar system.
Do you have any plans to teach different classes other than biology and Earth space science?
At this point, this is where I'm at. I don't have plans to teach other classes. In the future, I may be involved with one of the academies when that moves into the 11th grade year, but that's still in the planning stages. So I am very happy with where I'm at right now. I feel very lucky to be teaching Earth space science and biology.
For those that don't know, Benson has an academy system, or we're developing an academy system, where our majors are going to be grouped up into communications, tech skills, health occupations. That only applies to our sophomores right now, and it's definitely a change from how we've been doing things in the past, where majors are are just their own classes that kind of exist. The academy system is going to try and interweave our majors with our regular classes. What do you think of the academy system in the Sunbrana?
I am still getting to know its pros and cons. I know that the projects that the sophomores have been involved in, the academy projects, have been really impressive. And so I see at the end what incredible interdisciplinary work students are doing. I hope that it can expand to the juniors, because that's when we're going to see its true strength, is when we can get that vertical movement of the skills through the high school career. I am encouraged by it. I am not part of the planning or anything like that, so I'm kind of an outside viewer on the academies at this point. Thank you, Vinny, for giving me this opportunity to talk to you about teaching here at Benson. I think Benson is one of the best schools in Portland, and I feel really lucky to be part of it.
Well, we feel lucky to have you, Miss Umbrana. This has been Vinny with KBPS. We'll see you next time.
Hey, it's Ariana from KBPS Radio Broadcasting at Benson High School. Thank you, Schoolhouse Supplies. I really appreciate you because of the material you have given Benson High School. I am using a notebook at school thanks to you. You are helping me at school to do my government work that I need to do and being able to use the markers to underline the important details. I'm thankful for you and the supplies you have given us because we are able to make the banners with markers you have given us. I'm thankful for Schoolhouse Supplies because I have used many equipment in class. They are helping me to get my work in and being able to look for easy access when writing. I appreciate you and everyone who has donated supplies very much.
Thank you, Schoolhouse Supplies. This is Daniel Bergen from KBPS Radio Broadcasting at Benson Polytechnic High School. I'm thankful for you and the supplies you give us because I don't always come to class prepared. So when that happens, I'm grateful to lean on your supplies when I'm not ready. Like if I don't have my notebook, I can use your provided papers to write and keep up with class. Or if I don't have my pencils to write with, it helps me get more work done in less time. So thank you once again.
Hey, it's Fran from KBPS Radio Broadcasting at Benson High School. Thank you so much, Schoolhouse Supplies, for the various supplies you've given us, and I think they will be very useful here at KBPS. So thank you so much.
Hi, my name is Jasmine from the KBPS Radio Broadcasting at Benson High School. Thank you so much, Schoolhouse Supplies. I am using the colored pencils, markers, the crayons to use for coloring paper and also to just draw in my free time at school. Thanks to you, you are helping me at school to express my creative side when it comes to art. Keep up the good work.
Hey, it's Leslie Ann from KBPS Radio Broadcasting at Benson High School. Thank you, Schoolhouse Supplies. I really appreciate you because some students who are in need and some students who can't really afford school supplies and just the KBPS team, how we are all just one big family, and you sitting here and donating us the things that we need, I am just so thankful because we do projects like making posters and doing other little things, and we may need pencils for classwork or just other little things, and you sitting here donating these things to us, I am just so very grateful.
Hey, it's Travis from KBPS Radio Broadcasting at Benson High School. Thank you, House School Supplies. I appreciate you because you help kids and teachers save money and give us the tools that not every day student can use, making teachers' jobs easier. So thank you very much for helping us as a community.
Hey, AM1450, it's Ileana Brown back. I just want to say thank you to the school, House Supplies. Thank you for providing KBPS classroom with free supplies like paper, pencils, pens, and art supplies and more. It helps students succeed, and other students that may not have pencils, papers, scissors, etc., due to like home problems or not getting that much income. So we really appreciate you and thank you for the help and support.
Hi there, I'm Justin Fernander, and thank you, School House Supplies, for allowing Mr. Patterson, one of our greatest teachers here at school, to have free access to school supplies. That free school supplies has helped us a ton, so we just want to say thank you.
Hi, my name's Vinny, and I'm a student at KBPS, and I'm an avid user of the School House Supplies resources. In the event that I lose a notebook or I need to get a new one, the supplies are there for me and available. And it's just great. It's really awesome, and I hugely appreciate it. Thank you to School House Supplies and everyone that donates.
Hi, my name is Alexander Blake Pulsefoot from KBPS Radio Broadcasting at Benson High School. Thank you so much, School House Supplies. I am using your pencil pouch at school, thanks to you. You're helping me to do schoolwork, and it's been a real help and a lifesaver whenever I forget pencils at school. And I'm very appreciative of you all, and I appreciate everything that you guys do. And I hope you guys have a wonderful day or night. Thanks.
Hi, my name is Oscar from the KBBS Radio Broadcasting at Benson High School. Thank you so much, School House Supplies, that I'm using this notebook at school thanks to you. You are helping me at school to do homework assignments and all kinds of writing. I'm thankful for you and the supplies you give us because I get to do homework and a bunch of assignments. I'm thankful for School House Supplies because I used pencils and pens in class. They are really helping me to write and do everything I need to do. I appreciate you and everyone who donates supplies very much.
If you'd like to support the Student Hour, please consider donating to our program at kbps.am and donating to our sponsors, Portland Radio Project. Your support of PRP helps programs like the Student Hour stay on the air. For more information, go to prp.fm and click on the big red heart.
The Student Hour, highlighting student voices from around Portland and beyond. The Student Hour is powered by AM 1450 KBPS broadcasting students at Benson High School. Full episodes of the Student Hour are available on our website, kbps.am. On air since 1923, KBPS is the voice of the Portland Public Schools. Thanks to our supporters, Portland Radio Project, KBOO Community Radio, and thanks to our listeners like you. This concludes our episode for today. For AM 1450 KBPS, I'm Joe Anderson. Thanks for joining us.